and a longtime friend of the family who'd supported his store since it opened in 2010. Over the years, they'd become one of the best firearms dealers in West Texas. As Lucy craned her neck to locate Warwick, he walked up behind her and announced himself. "Good morning, Miss Lucy." This startled Lucy somewhat, who jumped a little. "Oh, I'm sorry," Warwick apologized profusely as he stuck his hand out to greet Palmer. "Probably shouldn't sneak up on folks in a gun shop. You must be Palmer. I'm Kirk, the store owner." "Nice to meet you, Kirk. Mama's just real excited to pick up her new toys." Warwick chuckled as he gave Lucy a hug. "Well, y'all will be real pleased with what we have for you. Follow me into the presentation room and I'll retrieve your order. We don't want to make a big deal of what you've bought in front of these other folks." "Okay," replied Lucy. She understood Warwick's suggestion of privacy. He always implored his customers to keep their weapons purchases under wraps. "Your arsenal," he always said, "was not something to brag about to your friends and neighbors." After a few minutes, he returned with two pistol-sized cases and a box containing a rifle, which he set aside for the moment. He pulled the curtains closed and turned his attention to his customers. "I believe you're going to love these weapons," began Warwick, as he popped open the hard plastic carrying case and presented matching Heckler & Koch VP9 tactical handguns to Lucy. "As requested, Miss Lucy, we've equipped these with threaded barrels. The factory's cold hammer forging process will guarantee you 80,000 to 90,000 rounds without a problem through these barrels." "How many?" asked Palmer, as she cocked her head in disbelief. "Who shoots that much?" "With training sessions included, you'd be surprised," replied her mother. Lucy picked up one of the weapons and felt the weight. She was pleased with its light feel and balance. Palmer followed her mother's lead and expertly cleared the chamber. She and her brothers had been trained in the safe handling of firearms from the day they were old enough to pick up a BB gun. Major believed in teaching them to be comfortable around weapons and respect their capabilities. "Also," began Warwick, "I didn't mention this in my voicemail to Major, but something else was approved for you guys." He reached into the chair next to him and showed Lucy their new Silencer Co. Omega 9K suppressor, the smallest, lightest, and quietest silencer available under 5 inches. "Wow," exclaimed Lucy. "Already? I thought it would take 9 months for approval." Warwick smiled. "Do you remember when you and Major came in and placed your order? Silencer Co. had just implemented a program where they provided an attorney to help jump through the federal logistical hurdles. The attorney eliminated some of the pre-purchase requirements, like obtaining written approval from local law enforcement and fingerprinting. The approval process for guns takes about 20 minutes in most cases, but a suppressor can take 9 or 10 months. Palmer picked up the silencer and studied the threads. "It screws onto the end of my gun, too?" Warwick nodded. "Absolutely. They are designed for both of your weapons." "Okay," started Palmer. "I have to ask, why do I need a silencer or suppressor? I mean, I'm not going to go stalking somebody like a secret agent or something." Lucy began to laugh. "Because, in her mind, one never knows." "I urge folks to practice using their weapons, Palmer," replied Warwick. "The suppressor reduces the risk of hearing loss, and it also acts as a muzzle brake, allowing you faster follow-up shots when necessary." Palmer shrugged. "Why not, right?" Warwick nodded, and then retrieved the box containing the rifle Major ordered. He opened the box and displayed a Daniel Defense DD5V1 rifle. He handed it to Lucy, who held it gingerly in both hands. "It's lighter than I imagined," was her first comment. "Around 8 pounds," said Warwick. "Is that a machine gun?" asked Palmer. "No, those are illegal," replied Warwick. "Basically, it's a more powerful version of the AR-15s your folks have purchased from me over the years. Only this particular weapon is chambered in .308. "Like my hunting rifle, right?" asked Palmer. Warwick nodded and smiled. "Miss Lucy might remember this, but from the first time your folks became my customers, I impressed upon them to purchase weapons in common calibers. For example, try to purchase all your handguns in either 9mm or .45 caliber. Your AR-15 rifles all use .223 Remington. Your hunting rifles all take .308. Lucy handed the AR-10 platform weapon to her daughter. Palmer held it, and then carefully pointed it away from the other occupants in the room to get an idea of how it felt in a shooter's stance. "I like this. Can you hunt with it?" You can, and a lot more, replied Warwick. With the right scopes, you'll find this weapon to be just as versatile as your AR-15s, but with more firepower and a much longer range. Mama, I may have to arm-wrestle Daddy over this one, said Palmer with a chuckle. She looked over to her mother, who seemed to be oblivious to the conversation, as she stared at her phone. Mama, is everything okay? Lucy held up one finger, indicating for Palmer to wait for her answer. She continued to type a message to someone. When she finished, she immediately removed her glasses and looked at Warwick. Kirk, Major wants you to order another one of these. Then she turned to Palmer with a grin. One is none, right, honey? Chapter 30, November 11th, Stockyard Championship Rodeo, Fort Worth, Texas. With the not-so-secret injury to Cooper's head on the forefront of Miss Lucy's mind, she insisted on checking the truck and trailer to make sure he'd left his gear behind as promised. She then threatened each and every one of them, reminding her rodeo kids in no uncertain terms that if Cooper got within 20 yards of a bull, including the mechanical kind in a bar, she'd provide them a whoopin' they'd never forget. None of the three laughed at the prospect of their mama tanning their hides. Despite the fact they were all bigger and grown adults, they honestly feared her mama grizzly side. It took about 4 hours to drive to the Fort Worth Stockyards, where the season finale of the Stockyard Championship Rodeo was taking place that weekend. This was the next-to-last event before the PBR World Championship in Las Vegas. Had Cooper's head fully healed, he would have ridden at Fort Worth, although the prize money was insufficient to vault him into the top 10 and keep him there. The event at the Calgary Stampede in 2 weeks was the date he'd circled on his mental calendar, and he had no intention of incurring a setback prior to then. Plus, for once, this rodeo could be all about Riley and Palmer. After they got settled, they registered for their respective events, and Cooper made small talk with some of his fellow bull riders. Most were supportive, as they developed mutual respect for one another over time. There were others, naturally. The haters, as Cooper referred to them, who secretly wished Cooper would disappear into obscurity. He'd come out of nowhere to reach his level of success, and the haters wanted nothing more than to see Cooper fail. When he encountered these losers, he'd remember words that Pops taught him when he was young. Don't worry about failing, but concentrate only on winning. Cooper did win, and often, which only exacerbated the jealousy among the haters. The rodeo events calendar was full for both Friday and Saturday, although Riley's event was only scheduled for Friday evening as part of the day's final competitions. Riley was the perfect build for a steer wrestler. Speed and strength were the attributes found in champions, and Riley excelled in both. Steer wrestlers, also known as bulldoggers, used power and technique to wrestle the steer to the ground. That might sound simple enough, but then the real work began. The steer weighed twice as much as his opponent, the bulldogger. Once the two entered the arena, the steer wrestler chased the animal on his horse, typically at 30 miles per hour. Riley would start on his horse confined in a box. The steer was given a head start, the length of which was determined by the size of the arena. The arena at the Fort Worth Stockyards was large, so Riley had plenty of room to work. Cooper and Palmer stood on the rails of the box where Riley readied himself behind the barrier. As the steer reached a precise advantage point, the chase would be on. You got this, Riley, said Cooper, as he shouted words of encouragement over the noise of the crowd. Riley was getting hyped up, the adrenaline pumping through his veins. He's a big un, Coop. Did you see the size of that boy? Heck, you should be riding that sucker. Nah, he's a pussycat, said Cooper. Remember, you're smarter than he is. Riley managed to smile, despite his rapidly building intensity. It was almost time to release the steer from the breakaway rope barrier. Riley's muscles tensed, his brow furrowed, and he took a moment to pull his black felt cowboy hat lower on his forehead. Riley glanced to his right and nodded to his hazer. In steer wrestling, the rider had the assistance of a hazer, another mounted cowboy who galloped his horse along the right side of the steer and kept it from veering away from the bulldogger. The top 10 steer wrestlers in the world had a partner who acted as the hazer who could be nearly as important as those who wrestled the steer. Riley shared a hazer with several other steer wrestlers at this stage in his career, and usually shared a quarter of his earnings with the hazer. His hazer nodded back and gave him a thumbs up. Riley was ready. Steer wrestling differed from bull riding, in which remaining on the bull 8 seconds completed the event. In steer wrestling, the fastest time wins, so it was important to have a fast, responsive horse, and the bulldogger had to time his takedown perfectly. Riley had to be aware not to break through his barrier prematurely, for that would result in a 10-second penalty and likely keep him out of the money. He waited patiently as the cowboys controlling the steer's breakaway rope watched him. Seconds later, the steer was released, and the chase was on. The chase resembled a drag race between the steer, the bulldogger, and the hazer. Riley kicked his heels, and his horse bolted forward. Within 2 seconds, he was alongside the steer, even before his hazer was. As Riley pulled alongside, he slid down off the right side of his horse, which continued to race ahead, and then he hooked his right arm around the powerful steer's right horn. In one simultaneous motion, Riley grabbed the steer's left horn, locked it in his grip, and using all the strength and leverage he could muster, slowed the steer, and then leaned. However, Riley's work wasn't complete. In order to stop the clock, he had to wrestle the steer flat on its back, with all 4 feet pointed in the same direction. First, Riley stuck out his feet and slid with the steer's forward process, kicking up dirt, but slowing the beast at the same time. With this leaning motion, Riley had gained momentum before he rotated his body, turned the steer, and flipped him. With one fell swoop, Riley flawlessly dropped the steer to the ground, its feet flying upward, causing the clock to stop. The announcer said it all. Riley Armstrong's time of 5.8 seconds vaults him into first place. He removed his hat and waved to the cheering crowd in the arena as the night's rodeo events concluded. Riley would go home with a $1,500 check and a trophy in the form of a champion steer rustler buckle, sponsored by Wrangler. After the arena was cleared, Cooper and Palmer jumped over the rail to celebrate with their brother. Cooper had already achieved notoriety around the pro rodeo circuit, and now Riley was making a name for himself. Tomorrow would be Palmer's day, but at age 21 she was still new to the National Barrel Horse Association circuit. In all of her shows, she competed with the best and typically earned top 10 finishes, although she hadn't yet been in the money. Palmer was patient and knew she had to gain experience and pay her dues, just like her brothers. "I think this calls for a celebratory bud, don't y'all think?" asked Palmer, who, despite having just turned 21 in recent months, was always the first to suggest a cold beer following an event. "My mouth is still full of dirt," said Riley. "I need to wash it down with something." "Let's do it," said Cooper, as he led his siblings out of the arena. "Y'all thinking Billy Bob's?" Riley started to laugh. "We'd best not risk it. It's Friday night, bull night in there." In the early years, Gilly's was a cowboy bar located just outside Houston that had become world famous when it was featured in the movie Urban Cowboy. When the co-owners had a falling out, the club closed and was relocated to Dallas, a move that included the original mechanical bull, El Toro, featured in the movie. Not to be outdone, Billy Bob's at the Stockyards embarked on what turned out to be a brilliant marketing strategy. They installed an actual bull-riding arena within their honky-tonk and adopted the slogan, "Real Bulls, Not Steel Bulls." Bull-riding at Billy Bob's became a regular Friday night occurrence and was run like a professional rodeo event. Points were awarded for the way the bull bucked, the degree of difficulty, and the technique used by the rider. Because the arena was located within the confines of the bar, the ring was tight, which encouraged the bull to buck fierce and spin tight. Even as Cooper was rising through the ranks, he'd never considered riding at Billy Bob's, despite the notoriety he might have achieved. He thought it was too dangerous, because bulls were unpredictable enough, much less in a confined space. In addition, Riley's point was well taken. "I agree, Riley," said Cooper. "Would it surprise you that Mama has spies everywhere? They're probably following us now." Palmer and Riley began to look around nervously, causing Cooper to chuckle. "Where are we going to go?" asked Palmer, as she looked around at the crowd of people descending upon the Stockyards for a night of drinking and dancing. Cooper saw a neon sign that read, "Basement Bar," pointing down a flight of stairs. A chalkboard sign on the inside of the door displayed the bar's specials, No cover, $2 beer, $2 Wells. Cooper smiled, as all three specials met their budgets. The rodeo kids were not big drinkers. They usually enjoyed no more than two beers. Their interest in frequenting these cowboy bars at the end of the day was usually for the camaraderie of their fellow rodeo participants. After the trio produced their IDs, confirming they were 21, they entered the small but noisy bar, which billed itself as the world's smallest honky-tonk. They made the rounds and chatted with familiar faces. Riley and Cooper were catching up with two up-and-coming bull riders from San Antonio, Adriano Morales and Eduardo Pacheco. The guys were from Brazil, having immigrated to America with their parents in 2015, when political uprisings dominated the country and the economies of South America began to collapse. Their fathers were employees of InBev, one of the world's largest beer companies, which had merged with Anheuser-Busch. With the completed acquisition of Corona Beer and Grupo Modelo, whose marketing arm was located in San Antonio, the boys' parents sought positions there and came to Texas on L visas designed for intercompany employee transfers. Their parents worked to achieve their American citizenship, and the boys continued to pursue their dreams of being bull riders. Cooper enjoyed talking with Morales and Pacheco because the Brazilians employed a slightly different bull riding strategy in dealing with the rope and grip. They were comparing notes when suddenly Riley tapped Cooper on the chest and nodded toward Palmer, who was involved in a conversation with two cowboys at the bar. Two guys, clearly full of themselves and probably several beers too many, were shouting at Palmer, who turned her back to them. "Hey, girl, what's your problem? Me and my brother are just trying to be friendly." One of the men reached for her arm to turn her around, but Palmer spun and said, "Friendly leads to conversation, and I don't feel like talking. Leave me alone." She yanked her arm away from the man's hand and swung around, her ponytail swishing behind her. The guy slammed his beer on the bar and growled, "Maybe you ought to learn a little respect, hussy." He began to follow after her, but he was immediately stopped by a charging bull in the form of Riley Armstrong. It all happened so fast that Cooper couldn't recall if Riley was more steer wrestler, middle linebacker, or his nemesis, one-night stand. In any event, a certified Western bar brawl broke out. Riley had knocked the wind out of the rude cowboy and immediately began to rain Hail Marys into the man's jaw. When the guy's friend tried to jump Riley, Pacheco kicked his legs, causing him to crash to the floor in pain. Another bar patron, apparently friends with the two loudmouths, jumped on Cooper's back, who began to spin around in circles, emulating a bull trying to throw his rider. The man held on until one final spin, when his face met the fist of Morales, causing him to loosen his grip on Cooper and fly onto and then over the bar. Pacheco finally got Riley's attention and forced him to stop the beatdown of the worst offender. Riley's hands were bloodied, but not near as bad as the other guy's face. As others in the bar pushed and shoved each other just to be part of the action, the lights came on and the bouncers moved in to control the crowd. Cooper grabbed everyone and whispered to them, "Quick, this way." Several of the bar's patrons wanted no part of the fight and scurried for the exit. Cooper guided the group to blend in with everyone else so they wouldn't be identified by the guys who still lay on the floor, writhing in pain. At the top of the stairs, they emerged into the cool, fresh air, and then scampered down West Exchange to the White Elephant Saloon, where a line stretched around the block to get in. The five of them didn't say a word as they heaved in and out to catch their breath. Palmer kept a watchful eye on the street to see if they were being pursued by anyone, but it appeared they were in the clear. All at once, the group began to laugh hysterically. Pacheco pulled a bandana out of his jeans and handed it to Palmer, who wrapped Riley's hand. "We'd better get some ice on this before it swells up too badly," said Palmer. "It ain't broke," said Riley. "Maybe." "Let's see," said Palmer as she gave it a squeeze. "Hey, dang it, Palmer, that hurt worse than the punches I was landing." As the group had a good laugh, two Fort Worth patrol cars drove toward the bar with their blue lights flashing, reflecting off the walls of the stockyards as they passed. Cooper laughed and then got serious. "Quit your squalling. We need to get off the streets anyway." Morales laughed and patted Riley on the back. With his heavy Spanish accent, he said, "I see why you wrestle the steers. You're the baddest cowboy I've ever seen." "Thanks," said Riley. And thanks, guys, for pulling me off that jackass. I was out of my mind. I might have killed him if y'all hadn't stopped me. No problem, my friend, said Pacheco. We have to ride tomorrow and must get some sleep. Cooper shook their hands and slapped them on the shoulders. I wish I could ride with you, but I'm out. Thanks for your help tonight. If we ever need to return the favor, I promise we'll have your backs. Chapter 31. November 12th. The Oval Office. The White House. Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. was full of diplomats. Some wielded authority and real power, including the authority to bind their countries to verbal agreements. Others were simply figureheads and mouthpieces for their government. One person likened it to the husband who claimed he couldn't make a decision on a car without consulting his wife, who was at the other end of the showroom, hiding from the salesman. While administrations came and went, as did the power between political parties, one rule remained constant in the duties of Washington's diplomats. Think twice before you say nothing. Ambassador Ho Lin of China was an expert in listening, analyzing, and saying nothing. For nearly three decades, he'd infuriated State Department officials and presidents with his shrewd poker face, careful choice of words, and ability to say nothing in the midst of said diplomacy. He unconsciously caressed the folded leather pouch that rested in his lap as the Lincoln Town Car made its way through the security gates at the White House. His hands trembled slightly, but not out of nervousness, but rather from becoming old. Very few people in Washington knew that Ambassador Lin was approaching 80. A cold rain continued to fall outside, causing his view to be obscured by the rain-streaked windows. Not that it mattered. He'd come to the White House many times in his career to do battle. He'd learned the art to say the nastiest things in the nicest way, much to the chagrin of others. During his tenure, he'd always won these battles, even if his opponents didn't realize it. As the car approached the final 100 yards to the White House entrance, he managed a slight smile. China had been winning since that historic visit by President Richard Nixon in 1972. That seven-day trip ended 25 years of no communication or diplomatic ties between the two countries. Dubbed by Nixon to be the week that changed the world because of how it isolated the Soviet Union further geopolitically, it also opened up world markets to the Chinese. The result had been 50 years of economic dominance, which had built China into a communist superpower, dominating world trade with its exports and manning one of the most powerful military machines on the planet. Ambassador Lin was proud to say that most of this success for China happened on his watch and was due to his unparalleled diplomatic skills. Despite his successes and an innate ability to read the American political tea leaves, he was puzzled by the scheduling of this meeting. Had it been a matter of import, he would not have been given 5 days' advance notice. As the car pulled to a stop, Ambassador Lin fidgeted with his coat buttons and drew the collar tight around his neck. The cold, damp air didn't suit the elderly gentleman, even for the brief time it took to enter the White House. Then again, it was the lack of knowledge concerning the subject matter that troubled him most, leaving a cold spot in his gut. He had no idea what the Americans were going to say, and how they were going to say it, so he readied himself for a variety of scenarios. Ambassador Lin had become a student of American protocol. Today's meeting was a perfect example and was rich in tells, a poker term that described a player's behavior or demeanor that gave off clues as to their intentions. The first such tell was the presence of President Harmon, especially on a Saturday morning. He'd only met her once before, during a state visit by the Chinese president. Her presence today represented a disturbing twist in the normal diplomatic channels. Meeting with ambassadors was usually entrusted to the State Department. The second tell was the invitation itself. Ambassador Lin had been instructed to come alone. Under all circumstances, he would be accompanied by his deputy chief of mission. He made this his customary protocol to protect him from being misquoted to his superiors. In China, any traitorous activity would result in an instant recall and likely death. By their explicit instructions, the Americans were forcing him to come alone, which was within their right, but rarely exercised. except under extreme circumstances. Finally, the tell was the choice of location. Protocol dictated a neutral location for diplomatic meetings, such as the Roosevelt Room, where a majority of the sessions took place. A meeting scheduled in the West Wing lobby, located on the ground floor, indicated that the Americans were angry with your government. One could expect that to be a one-sided, brief conversation. Ambassador Lin entered into the warmth of the foyer and was escorted by Secret Service toward the Oval Office. This represented the third and easily the least common site for conferences. If the president wanted to ask for a favor of some magnitude, he'd call on the ambassador to meet in the Oval Office, because it was seen as a rare privilege and a sign of respect. However, as Ambassador Lin surmised because he couldn't think of any, there were no favors to be granted, which led him to believe he was summoned alone to the Oval Office and a direct meeting with President Harmon, because she was very angry with China. Two topics ran through his mind: the brutal vote in the United Nations and North Korea's upcoming missile test. He was prepared to respond to both matters. His instructions on the sanctions were clear. He was not to equivocate or concede any involvement in turning the other nations against the sanctions, which resulted in the landslide vote. With respect to North Korea, the answer would be the same as always. China was doing its best, but the DPRK was a sovereign nation with a will of its own. As he was led through the West Wing to the Oval Office, he thought of the final tell that would reveal the attitude of the Americans, the parties in attendance. If they were pleased with China and were looking for an important favor, he'd be greeted by the Deputy Secretary of State for China Affairs and the National Security Council officer assigned to China. As the door was opened for him, he was greeted by a young woman whom he'd never met. This concerned Ambassador Lin, but he steadied his nerves. It was a ploy, but it would not work on him. "Madam President, may I present Ambassador Ho Lin, Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary of the People's Republic of China, to the United States of America?" President Harmon stepped forward and extended her hand. "Good evening, Ambassador Lin." He reached forward and shook her hand. "I'm honored to be of service to you, Madam President, and naturally I bring greetings on behalf of the government of the People's Republic of China." Several people were in attendance, but none of them would speak, per protocol. The president would be the sole voice of the United States on this day. "Ambassador Lin," began President Harmon, as she gestured for the older man to take a seat as she did, "I'd like to discuss the matter of the rumored launch by North Korea of another ICBM missile. I hope you agree that Kim Jong-un has crossed the line in the sand agreed upon between China and the United States many times. Madam President, our country is committed to placing all the pressure it can to prevent such hostilities by North Korea. But as we've stated, they are a sovereign nation, and China can only do so much." Ambassador Lin relaxed in his chair, although he continued to rub his hands across his black leather pouch. China was very much aware of the DPRK's intended missile launch and had no intention of instructing Kim Jong-un to do otherwise. North Korea was a useful tool in keeping the United States at arm's length from any potential attack on China. Further, a divided Korean peninsula was preferred by Beijing, as opposed to a unified Korea under the control of Washington via its puppets in Seoul. "Mr. Ambassador, this upcoming launch has dire consequences for stability in the region," said the president. "Madam President, although I have no knowledge of any proposed missile test, might I say that the prior tests by North Korea were conducted safely without incident or threat to life?" "Without incident, perhaps, but not necessarily without threat to life. These missile launches routinely pass over Japan, and that must stop." "Yes, Madam President, of course, I understand your position. Again, let me reiterate our position. North Korea is a sovereign nation, and China's capabilities and influence are limited." President Harmon leaned forward and smiled. "I understand your position as well. We see two alternatives, then. Here's our first proposal. We'd ask that you use your considerable influence over Kim Jong-un, which you so deftly downplay, to redirect his ICBM missile test in the direction of the South China Sea." For the first time in Ambassador Lin's diplomatic career, he managed a smile and spontaneous laugh. He really didn't know how to respond. President Harmon continued, "Mr. Ambassador, I can see by your reaction that you consider my request foolish. Perhaps you think that I'm crazy to ask the People's Republic of China to allow an ICBM test over its sovereign territory. I can respect that, but I need you to relay this to Beijing. The days of talk are over. Japan will no longer tolerate intercontinental ballistic missiles flying over its citizens. The United States will no longer allow the DPRK to threaten our nation with nuclear annihilation while they launch ICBMs toward our shores. If China cannot fix this problem and convince Kim Jong-un to stop these tests, then efforts at diplomacy end right here, right now. I hope you understand my meaning, Mr. Ambassador." Ambassador Lin stood in silence as President Harmon's words hung in the air of the Oval Office. He nodded to each of the attendees, and then finally to President Harmon. "I will relay your message to the President immediately upon my return to the embassy, Madam President. Thank you." President Harmon rose and shook the ambassador's hand. "Thank you for coming. Please extend my warmest greetings to President Jinping and the esteemed members of the Politburo." Chapter 32. November 12th, 35th Fighter Wing, Misawa Air Force Base, Japan. It was day 4 after they'd received their orders and redeployed to a specially designated secure compound at Misawa Air Force Base. The base was shared with elements of the Japan Air Self-Defense Force, which had occupied the area as a military stronghold since 1870, when it was established as a stud farm for the Japanese Emperor's cavalry. Although the bulk of the facilities were utilized by the U.S. Air Force's 35th Fighter Wing, a secured high-clearance complex was set aside for the 373rd Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Group, or ISRG. The ISRG provided Misawa and the Pacific Command with strategic intelligence and real-time monitoring of operations within the theater. Today, ISRG was hosting the deputy director of the Korea Mission Center, a division of the CIA dedicated to dealing with Kim Jong-un and North Korea. He was conducting a private briefing with Duncan and Park. "Gentlemen, my name is Walter Campbell, deputy director of the Korea Mission Center. I'm meeting with you in private for a reason. Over the last 4 days, you've been expected to familiarize yourself with your insertion point, the timetable and locales of your mission, and your extraction. Do you feel adequately prepared for what's about to be asked of you?" Park and Duncan looked at one another and shrugged. Duncan, who'd learned from his father to hold his tongue, resisted the urge to respond with, "Yeah, I can now go sightseeing in North Korea. Other than that, the answer is most likely no." "Yes, sir," responded Duncan appropriately. Campbell looked to Park, who nodded as well. "Gentlemen, in 3 days, our source within the DPRK has provided solid intelligence that the North Koreans will be launching an ICBM test at Kusong. Do you know where that is?" Duncan bristled at the unnecessary question, meant to ferret out whether they were prepared. He and Park had studied and drilled one another on the geography and history of the region, including the importance of the DPRK's military base at Kusong as an ICBM launch facility. He decided to throw it back at the condescending spook. 40 degrees north, 125 degrees 10 minutes east is the location of the ICBM launch pad, which was constructed in 2014 July, replied Duncan smugly. Campbell didn't reply or acknowledge Duncan's obvious snarky response. "At 8 a.m. local time on the 15th, the DPRK has scheduled the launch of an ICBM missile. Kim Jong-un will be there to observe. Your orders are to assassinate him while he is available in a semi-public setting." Duncan leaned back in his chair and allowed the directive to sink in. Killing a member of the Kim dynasty of leaders in North Korea had always ended in failure and ruin for the assassins. The Kim regime and its predecessors had fought off challengers since the days of Japanese colonialism on the Korean Peninsula in the 1930s. When communist regimes were collapsing around the world in the 1990s, the Kims' hold on power continued. Despite geopolitical challenges and lethal attacks from within and without, the Kim dynasty had always managed to dodge would-be assassins using their uncanny survival skills and an elaborate network of bodyguards, informants, and undercover secret police. "I've assumed this possibility," said Duncan. "A direct assault on the capital, whether covert or via special ops, would be suicide. Even if we could breach the defenses of their Third Corps or Fourth Corps, he and his family would have more than enough time to escape." "Why don't you just drop a bunch of missiles on his head using the B-1Bs flying up and down the coast?" asked Park. "Mr. Park, that would be considered an overt military act," replied Campbell. "Your successful mission will provide Seoul and Washington plausible deniability. The agency has a disinformation campaign ready to make Kim's assassination appear to come from his own people." Duncan pulled out a map of the Kusong base and studied the aerial of the ICBM launch pad. "I've seen images in our materials provided by Langley of Kim Jong-un watching his missile tests. Do we have one specific to Kusong?" Park began thumbing through the images. He slid out an 8x10 image, which was provided by the North Korean state media. He pushed it into the center of the table. "This image was from last summer. It appears to be at the edge of some woods overlooking the launch pad." The image depicted Kim Jong-un sitting at a table with his fingers clasped on top of a map. He was in a jovial mood, grinning from ear to ear, with two of his senior-level officials dressed in their black Politburo suits and five tickled pink generals, all smiling for the camera. "We have to assume that this position is somewhere near the base facilities," said Duncan. "If we can get a closer look at satellite recon images, we could pinpoint this spot." Park pulled the picture back in front of him and pointed toward the mountain behind Kim. He then unfurled a large topography map of the Kusong area and laid it out for Duncan to see. "Let me find a ruler," said Park. "Don't bother," started Duncan. "This will be close enough." Duncan used a pencil and measured in increments against the scale of the map. 2 inches per quarter mile," he mumbled. "This mountain range appears to be about a mile away with plenty of elevation to take the shot." "Are you accurate from a mile away?" asked Campbell. "I'll need the right tools," responded Duncan. "Can our British friends get me what I need?" "Most likely," replied Campbell. "That doesn't answer my question. Can you make the shot?" Duncan studied the image and the map again. He tapped his fingers on the pine trees and a dirt embankment behind the observation area. "There are always variables to contend with, including the fact that this location may be moved elsewhere around the launch pad. These pine trees pose a problem, as does this embankment. It's something we'll have to address when we're on the ground there." "What about the distance?" asked Campbell. "Park and I have successfully made longer shots. 30 years ago, the thought of hitting a target at a mile or more was the stuff of legend. As the Barrett 50 cal rifles became more sophisticated and the optics more precise, even 2 mile shots were attained. Out at the ranch, I could peg empty water bottles with my .308 at nearly a mile, but that required a lot of practice. In this case, hitting Kim from a mile or so will require the perfect combination of cartridge, rifle, optics, and accessories." "And skill," added Park. "You'll have to pull this off using a never-seen-before rifle and a single well-placed shot. There won't be any second chances, cowboy." Campbell pulled out his phone and opened up his notes app. "Tell me your first and second choices of the tools you'll need, and we'll get the message to MI6. Duncan began to make some notes, and Park looked over his shoulder. He muttered a couple of suggestions, and Duncan incorporated them into the list. After a minute or two, Duncan's list was complete, and he read it aloud. "First option is the Barrett assembly. Using the 50 caliber Barrett cartridge, any of the bolt-action model rifles, compatible with 50 BMG, such as Robar, Steyr, Macmillan, or, of course, Barrett, will do. The second option is a .338 Lapua mag cartridge. The Lapua is used by tactical law enforcement units in the States. My daddy's Texas Ranger Company C had some dang fine shooters who could nail 2,000-yard targets with their .338 rounds. If the Brits can rustle me up a Bushmaster chambered in a .338 Lapua, that would work well." Campbell typed in the details and then looked up from his phone. Will the optics choices be interchangeable between the two rifle platforms? Yes, because these rifles will have similar 16 to 18-inch rails for mounting scopes. I need a reticle with around 20 times magnification. Anything larger is rough on the eyes and can mess with my adjustments. For a one-mile shot, I need a scope with a wide range of windage and elevation adjustments, especially for this time of year. We've been tracking the weather, and a front is moving in. If it arrives before we take the shot, it's most likely going to be a bust. Okay, give me some options, said Campbell. Leopold Mark IV, Night Force NSX, and, Park, what's that scope we used in Belarus? Horus. It's spelled H-O-R-U-S, like ours, sort of, but pronounced Horus. They're based in Idaho and are great if we have wind issues. Campbell made his notes, and then Duncan added a final item to the list. Horus also offers a ballistic range system that would be a huge help. See if he can pick up their vision sighting system. We can input everything from atmospheric conditions to the size of the cartridge. I know that's a big ask, but it could help us achieve success. Bipod? Asked Campbell. No, thanks, replied Duncan. We'll make a makeshift sandbag rest of some kind. Oh, and add a spotting scope that has a range of a mile. Pentax, Nikon, Swarovski, any of those three will do. Campbell finished his notes and then sent a message to someone to put in the wish list for fulfillment. He appeared to be readying himself to leave before Duncan decided to ask a few more questions. I have to ask this question since we're the ones that may not come out of there alive, started Duncan. How reliable is your intel on this? Who are we relying upon to set this up? Armstrong, you know the drill, replied Campbell with a gruff. Need to know basis only. It's our asses on the line, Mr. Campbell. Give me something. Campbell hesitated and looked into Duncan's eyes. He appeared to give the best answer possible without breaking protocol. She is as close a confidant to dear leader as they come, without being married to the man. She's very uncomfortable with the direction the country is headed, and especially with respect to human rights violations. She's made it clear the time to act is now. You do realize this is a suicide mission, don't you? This close confidant better be right. Campbell leaned forward with both hands on the table. Gentlemen, you knew the risks of these operations when you signed on. You've never failed before, and we have 100% confidence this mission will be successful. Get your head on straight, hit your mark, and then get the hell out. Now, are we good?
Good as gold, replied Duncan.
Good. Get your gear together because you ship out in an hour, said Campbell as he headed for the door. Then he spun and added, Gentlemen, you're dark from this point forward. No conversations with anyone, family included. Clear?
As crystal, replied Park.
Part 3 Chapter 33 November 13th The Yalu River, Sinweju, North Korea. The Chinese-flagged ferry left the United Nations freighter, which had anchored in Korea Bay. The freighter was part of a pre-scheduled humanitarian mission by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United States. The FAO-UN, an agency of the United Nations, was created to lead international efforts on behalf of developing and third-world countries to lessen poverty and hunger. Recognized worldwide as a politically neutral opportunity to help impoverished countries, even those like North Korea, FAO-UN modernized their farming operations and improved nutrition for all of its citizens. This particular relief effort was organized out of the FAO-UN regional office in Bangkok, Thailand. Duncan and Park took the positions of two pre-approved aid workers on the ship's manifest. Their documents were expertly created, and their records changed to allow their cover to pass muster. Duncan had been told that the North Korean border guards at Sinweju were not considered the A-team. The highly politicized and media-recognized Korean Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, along the 38th parallel, was protected by the DPRK's top soldiers. Sinweju was a busy port because of its proximity to Dandan, China, across the Yalu River. It was not surprising to have the North Korean guards be negligent in reviewing travel documents. As the ferry was approaching the docks, Park added his final thoughts. You weren't understating it, Duncan, said Park. This is suicidal.
Here we are, a couple of Americans, strolling into our fiercest enemy's clutches. Walk in the park? Nope. Capture results in death. Duncan furrowed his brow and grimly nodded. I get it. They could chuck us into the concentration camp here at Sinwaju, or even haul us to Kaishan, the worst of the worst. For the rest of our lives, added Park. I think we're getting closer to the docks, interjected Duncan. He pointed along the shore to a series of broken-down ships, tethered to equally ragged-looking wooden docks. This was a country that spent as little as possible on day-to-day infrastructure, but military spending had no limits. Seriously, Duncan, these guys will fire off nukes before we can run down the side of the mountain, continued Park, as the two men stood on the rail of the ferry puttering up the Yalu River. They're crazy enough to use them, too. If we pull this off, they'll feel like they've been embarrassed and will have nothing to lose. They're not going to turn the other cheek. It's going to be bad, right? Armageddon, mumbled Duncan. His mind raced to his days in church and sermons from Revelations. He often fantasized what Armageddon would look like. Park was right. They might be lighting the fuse by killing Kim Jong-un. Is it the right thing to do? Exactly. I'm less concerned about the North Koreans finding us than I am of one of our own nukes falling on our heads as we try to escape. Duncan and Park had worked on many dark ops missions in the past, and they certainly were aware of the ramifications of this one. This would easily be their toughest challenge. North Korea was difficult to get into, and even harder to get out of. The DPRK was infested with paranoid citizens who lived in fear of hiding secrets from the military. Their lives required that they spy on one another for fear of their loyalty being tested, and the ramifications of lack of disclosure to the authorities. The language barriers were minimized by virtue of Park being fluent in Korean, but the cultural differences prevented the two Americans from blending in. The one overriding concern was the lack of a backup plan or assistance. They would be on their own from the moment they stepped off the ferry in Sinwaju until they were extracted the afternoon following the assassination. Duncan had confidence he could make the shot. He knew they could pull it off. But would they be able to escape once the hornet's nest had been kicked? The ferry slowed to an idle as it coasted toward an available slip at the seaport of Sinwaju. Their instructions were explicit. Do not speak unless forced to. Park could speak Korean, as his cover allowed it. However, Duncan was to reply in simple German phrases, most of which he'd learned for prior European missions. The men returned to the rest of the relief workers and separated from one another. Duncan had identified an attractive young German woman who would garner a lot of attention from the North Korean border guards. His hope was to be passed through quickly while they spent more time with his traveling companion. Because he was of Korean descent, Park would be closely scrutinized. He intended to pass through their brief interrogation process first alongside the team leader of the FAO-UN group of 22 aid workers. The team leader, who was British, was also an operative for MI6, having been inserted into the FAO-UN organization shortly after its formation. She was fluent in Korean and would be able to handle any complications regarding Park's entry. If Park was rejected for some reason, Duncan would fall back and re-enter the ferry. He and Park would find an alternative means of entry. They had 6 hours before they were to meet their handler from MI6. After a few tense moments in which Park was carefully scrutinized, he was allowed in, and the rest of the FAO-UN contingent followed. Most were carrying duffels, carrying personal items such as clothing and bathroom sundries. A second set of North Korean guards rifled through these bags, often dumping the contents on the dock and kicking through clothing to see what the bags contained. If a camera or laptop computer was found, the scrutiny became more intense, and for some, lasted 2 hours. Park and Duncan were briefed on this in advance, and therefore did not bring any form of electronics with them. Naturally, Duncan and Park packed light, but believably. While the North Korean guards were not as thoroughly trained as TSA agents from the U.S., they were capable of pulling someone out of line for closer scrutiny on a whim. It was important for the two men not to draw attention to themselves, because once they entered the country, they planned on separating themselves from the group. There was precious little time to waste in getting to Kusong and their goal of looking at their options for establishing a sniper hide. While the men waited on the rest of the FAO-UN team to clear, they took some time to study their surroundings. North Korea was known as the world's most isolated country. What was not commonly known was that travel to North Korea was possible, as was working and investing in business. While China is the country's largest trading partner by far, there are European business interests that have invested in North Korean industries such as software, shipping, and mining. In addition to humanitarian aid workers, the most likely people to be seen in North Korea were exchange students, tour guides with their guests, businessmen, and, of course, diplomats from other countries, although the latter two groups were most likely to be found in Pyongyang. Ordinarily, tourists would be abundant in Sinwaeju because of its proximity to Dandong, China, across the Yalu River. Very few travelers could be observed due to the closing of the China-North Korea friendship bridge between the two cities. While not open to pedestrians, vehicular traffic between the two cities remained steady on most days. But Beijing's most recent attempts to bring pressure on North Korea to stop the upcoming ICBM test included closing the friendship bridge for repairs. The move was largely symbolic, because the new Yalu River Bridge had just opened a mile upriver after 10 years of construction. Periodically, a uniformed patrol would randomly stop apparent travelers and request to see their travel permit. Duncan and Park had rehearsed their responses to being detained during their preparations to comport to their visas and passports, as well as their connection to FAO-UN. It was a charade they'd carry on for less than 48 hours. After the assassination of Kim Jong-un, none of their rehearsed answers would likely help them. Chapter 34. November 13th. Dongrim Hotel. Dongrim, North Korea. Dongrim was located about 30 miles southeast of the seaport, about halfway to Kusong. The Dongrim Hotel, which housed aid workers, had the exterior appearance of a block and stucco warehouse. But on the inside, the furnishings rivaled that of a Hampton Inn or Marriott Courtyard Hotel. The staff was friendly, and the accommodations more than adequate, especially at a price tag of $29 per night. The room contained a flat-screen television, plush bedding, and a marble-enclosed shower. Duncan checked his Apple Watch, a detail overlooked by the North Korean border guards. While internet connectivity was not available, the apps loaded on his version included satellite access to maps, GPS tracking, and weather radar. After a one-hour power nap, the alarm on his watch woke him, and he took a quick shower. He finished dressing in clothing suggested by his CIA advisory team. In North Korea, the citizens were too poor or hungry to think much about clothing and fashion sense. However, based upon a North Korean's employment, their uniform might vary. The FAO-UN team suggested their team members wear blue jeans or khakis, along with shirts and jackets befitting the weather. It was the onset of winter, and most North Koreans wore a form of black or dark blue felt coat. Duncan and Park had packed predominantly black clothing to be worn, as they intended to travel to Kusong in the early nighttime hours. As the sun began to set, the men walked out into the cold evening air with a map, putting on their best tourist impressions. Even though the Dongrim Hotel had a nice dining room, the men sought out a restaurant where their contact from MI6 would be waiting. It was dark when the two tourists entered the Jade Stream Pavilion and sat at the dining bar overlooking the well-lit waterfalls outside the building. They were to remain seated, enjoy their dinner, and the MI6 operative would approach them toward the end of their meal. Halfway through dinner, a lanky Brit was seated next to Park and immediately began studying the menu. He sat in silence for several minutes until his order was placed. When he'd been served a glass of North Korean wine, he took a sip and grimaced. "Porter Kensington, at your service," he said under his breath. The MI6 operative was dressed in a pinstriped suit to lend the appearance of a businessman. Working under a New Zealand passport, Kensington's cover allowed him free travel through the country, as he was considered a valued investor in the North Koreans' magnesite mining operations in Tanchon. "As the wine?" asked Park, keeping his eyes forward on the dancing lights appearing through the waterfall. Kensington mumbled his response. Shameful. Horse swill. Park and Duncan finished their meal without further conversation. After the check was delivered, Kensington slipped a piece of paper to Park with an address on it. Then he mumbled, 20 minutes. With their tab settled, they walked into the street, which was devoid of traffic. Park, it's going to be hard for us to travel at night with the lack of traffic. We'll stick out to any military patrols. I agree, replied Park. Waiting until morning to move is like losing half a day. It's going to be cold, but I'd like to be set up in those mountains when the sun rises so we can identify a spot. Maybe our new friend can help, added Duncan. The men found their way to another hotel in Dongrim and waited in the karaoke bar as instructed. They suffered through several poorly performed American songs before they were approached once again by Kensington. This time, with no conversation, he passed Park a room key and abruptly left. Duncan and Park waited several minutes and then left the bar. That was brutal, said Duncan with a laugh. I bet that's what they do in these concentration camps, listen to terrible renditions of old Elvis Presley songs. No doubt, said Park, as the men entered Kensington's hotel and climbed the stairs to the second floor. They made their way to Kensington's door. Just as Duncan was about to insert the card key, the door swung open, and an arm motioned them into a pitch-black space. Duncan subconsciously reached for his waist to pull his sidearm, and then remembered where he was. His body tensed, preparing for a physical assault. He moved into the dark room, followed by Park, and the door shut behind them. Kensington, in a British accent that could just as well have been New Zealander, spoke to reassure the American operatives. Sorry about the cloak and dagger, gentlemen. They're prying eyes through the peepholes of my neighbors. This country's awash with paranoia, even among the visitors. Kensington removed his jacket and threw it onto a chair next to a desk. His room was furnished similar to the Dongrim Hotel. Duncan only noticed one suitcase, which lay open on the still-made bed. He glanced around the room, hoping to see signs of the weaponry he requested. My name's Park, and my friend is Armstrong. I'm sure you know as much about us as we know about you. Good point, Mr. Park, but none of that will matter by morning. In a few minutes, the three of us will depart Dongrim for the Pongyon Airport, which is 13 miles from the Kusong missile launch site. What happens then? Asked Duncan. There, a Sungri truck will be waiting for you. It contains a false bed that will withstand cursory inspections by the DPRK roaming patrols. The truck will be loaded with grain sacks containing water, wheat, and rye, consistent with your visas as FAO UN humanitarian workers. Duncan began to relax. Kensington was all business, and that suited him just fine. Do we require travel papers to approach Kusong? Yes, and those have been arranged. They'll be in the truck's dashboard compartment. I must caution you upon your approach. Once you cross the bridge at Taeryong River, the level of scrutiny rises substantially near the entrance to the military base at Kusong. Your travel permits will allow it, but the risk is great. Park approached the window and carefully parted the curtains to look at the streets of Dongrim. Traffic is sparse. Any attempt to approach the proposed site would be met with resistance every step of the way. That's correct, said Kensington. Your best attempt at ingress is the early dawn hours. Delivery trucks from Dongrim and the coastal villages along the Korean Bay will fill the road, and you'll be able to blend in. That puts us behind schedule, said Duncan. Any other options? Duncan thought for a moment and pulled a map out of his suitcase. You could travel along the river, which would require you to steal a small skiff. The other alternative is to hike. It will take you several hours to avoid detection, but you will be able to approach the launch site through the mountains. Okay, we'll figure it out on the ride up there, said Duncan. I assume nothing has changed since our last intel briefing yesterday morning. Correct, said Kensington, as he zipped up his suitcase. An inflatable will meet you both at the village of Sinmido at dusk that evening. Let me confirm for you that the target launch date is the 15th. The weather system will move in that afternoon, which would require them to abort the launch for at least a week, if not longer. There's no chance the launch has been moved up, is there? Asked Park. No, I'm assured of this by our resource. Let's talk about her for a moment, Duncan insisted. Are you 100% confident in your intelligence? Kensington pulled his suitcase off the bed and extended the handle in order to roll it behind him. He smiled slightly as he responded. Well, I'm sure. The two of